Let's turn, please, to 1 Samuel chapter 8. You recall the area of prayer that we have been studying for the last two Sundays is the area of prayer that pertains to whenever we make a petition or request something in prayer. And the reason for emphasizing that is because that is not the total picture of prayer. Prayer is not all made up of asking. There's the thanksgiving aspect. We're not talking about that right now. There's the worship aspect. We're not talking about that part right now. And there are several parts to prayer, but we are looking at the part of what happens and what is the pattern that you can derive from Scripture when we see a given situation and decide, either rightly or wrongly, that we have a need in this area. And when we recognize the need, then we make a petition which we think will solve the need if God will move on the thing. And that may be a good petition, it might be a bad petition, and then we're looking at how he responds. So as you recall, we've broken all prayer that pertains to getting answers and that has a petition in it into the why, the what, and the how. And we've been following that pattern for two Sunday mornings now in order. We'll complete that this morning and begin to start into the area of the prayer life of Christ. The important thing to remember, however, is any time you come across a prayer biblically, and we've only touched, lands, I don't know what percent, but just a very few. Any time you touch a prayer biblically where somebody asks for something, always, always stop and consciously ask yourself, why was the petition made? Specifically, what was it? And specifically, how did God answer it within the context? Now, one factor we did not bring into the picture, and we'll put it in only parenthetically because it is involved, is remember that between the why, the what, and the how, there is always the factor of time. In other words, the how does not have to be answered immediately. The how could be answered 2, 3, 4, 5 years. The only thing we can put with the time that I know of is strictly an observation, is that whenever you make a petition, that how God answers it as to time is that it is usually very slow. Now that's slow, strictly, from human view. Because we all have the characteristics of we want what we want, when we want it, the way we want it. Right? Jim? No one else responded to that. I just wanted to see if you were going to. Isn't that correct?
Correct.
All right. This morning we want to get started with everyone participating together in the group. All right? So that inevitably between the what or the petition made and the how, there is going to be time, and that time is strictly, you can't speed it up, you can't slow it down. That is purely the prerogative of God as to when the thing is going to be answered and the way He is going to do so. But never let the idea that time passes make us think that, that nothing's going to happen. It's just a matter of God has a calendar and has to come through on that standpoint, and we'll have to admit from human view it's slow. Because we always want our petitions answered, we want them answered immediately. If a child asks for a bicycle, when does he want it? He doesn't want it in 6 months, he wants it now. And we're no different in prayer. When we ask for something, when do we want it? We want it by the date prescribed, and that's fixed exactly when we want it. But God also takes into consideration, due to His omniscience, that that always is not wise either. So far, everything we have covered in the, I think, maybe six passages or so, we looked at the why, we looked at the what, and we looked at the how. And we found out that in each one of those cases, that the why, or the thing that the person wanted, was answered affirmatively. And we have found that in each case, the what they asked for was answered negatively. And in each case, we did not note how long the time was or how what the lapse was, though maybe we should have done it, but you could go back in context and determine that. And you recall the ones. For example, Paul hurts. That was the why. Take the thorn in the flesh away. Answer, that was a petition. And the answer, of course, is no, I will not take the thorn in the flesh away. The hurt, yes, I will supply. I will give you grace for it, but I will not answer your petition. And we've been enough over those to establish that particular pattern. Now we want to show by a couple of passages this morning that this can be reversed. Is that the thing, the why, or the motivation, we say we think we would like to have this because if we had it, then our petition being satisfied would satisfy what we really want. So it is possible to turn it around, and that's what we'll be looking at this morning, to see that it is possible to get a yes answer, an affirmative answer to what we ask for, but end up wishing we hadn't gotten it. In other words, is it possible for God to give an affirmative answer to a prayer, and then we find out that we regret that He did so? So that we'll put this in the category of, this is, of course, requires two things. First of all, it requires the attitude of submission to God's will, and we'll put it in this way, if it is your will. Now, that has to be an attitude in prayer. That does not mean that every prayer has to be ended by saying the rote words, we ask this petition, if it be your will. Because that could be mere words without an attitude. So when I put this up here in quotes, I don't mean that that little phrase has to be inserted in prayer. I do mean that that attitude must exist. If not, we run the possibility that God may turn our petition into a yes answer and the whole thing become discipline for not complying to God's will. So it is possible to have this type of thing. We want something. We have a motivation for it. We desire it. There's a definite why we want it. And coupled with that why is a great deal of determination. We are insistent that we've got to have that. In other words, we are willing to bargain with God. We're willing to say, look, I'll promise to be good for 5 days if you'll answer my prayer. I've just got to have, I'll do anything for it. I'll scrub floors. I'll even go to church if you'll give me an answer to my prayer. I'll do anything. I've got to have this. And the attitude in the petition is not one of submissiveness, that, yes, this is what I want, but I'm submissive to the will of God. This is non-submissive prayer, and it is a matter of absolute insistence that God do such, and God can, in such cases, reply by saying, okay, you are so insistent on what you want, I'm going to give it to you. And I'll give it to you to teach that you are not being compliant to God's will and therefore living in sin, and the answer will be yes, and you'll get the thing that you're asked for, and you'll be miserable to your dying day in having to live with it. Now, let's establish, first of all, that there can be the kind of prayer that asks for things that is legitimate, but it is not qualified by the if it is your will concept. And I said 1 Samuel. Let's go with 1 Samuel first, then we'll go to the other passage. 1 Samuel chapter 8. 1 Samuel 8. And again, let's set up the why, the what, and the how. Only this time we'll be seeing a different pattern than we have seen in the previous contexts. 1 Samuel chapter 8, verse 1 through 5. It came to pass when Samuel was old that he made his sons judges over Israel. Now the name of the firstborn was Joel, the name of the second Abijah. They were judges in Beersheba. And his sons walked not in his ways, but turned aside after money, took bribes, perverted justice. Then all the elders of Israel gathered themselves together unto Samuel to Ramah, and said to him, Behold, thou art old, and thy sons walk not in thy ways. Now make us a king to judge us like the nations. So notice what the motivation was. Really, a twofold why. Number one was they were living under unjust government or unjust rulers. And that's expressed back in the idea that your sons don't walk in your ways. They're turned aside after money. They take bribes. They've perverted justice. In other words, in Israel, we now have a set of unjust rulers. You can buy your day in court. You can purchase justice. Things are unfair. The men are not ruling righteously. And can you see then what the motivation would be? In the light of this perverted kind of government that we've got, these crooked rulers, we're going to make a petition. We want a change in the form of government. Logical? Very logical from the standpoint of if you were under a government with no justice, you could buy your day in court and so forth, which you, I guess, really can anyway. Living under those circumstances, wouldn't you, if it got severe enough, probably say, Lord, give us a change. We need some change at the top. Now, that wasn't the only motivation. The other motivation is also found down in verse 5, in the last part. Not only was it the internal problem of an unjust government that they had or unjust rulers, but they also said, make us a king to judge us like other nations. So not only was it their own unjust rulers that motivated the prayer, but it was also a desire to be like others. That also entered into the picture. They wanted to be like the other nations who had the form of government of kingship. So with a dual motivation then, a desire to be like the other nations and the corruption that was in their own government, from that issued the petition. And you notice the petition also is in verse 5. It is, make us a king. Now, from the human standpoint, that seems like a very logical, reasonable, understandable petition. Now, the problem with it was this. It wasn't so much that this petition was wrong. The attitude behind it was wrong. The attitude behind it was not make us a king, but if you choose not to, we'll accept the option. The attitude was this, make us a king or else. That was the attitude in their mind. Make us a king or else. In other words, we insist on an answer to this particular prayer. Now, the reason we know that there was an or else with it is the following context. Verse 6. The thing displeased Samuel when they said, give us a king to judge us. In other words, the prophet told them that the petition was out of line, and Samuel prayed to the Lord and presented their petition. The Lord said to Samuel, listen to the voice of the people in all that they say unto thee, for... Now, here's what's wrong with their petition. Notice their petition was wrong because their mental attitude was wrong. And their mental attitude was an attitude of rebellion against God's way. And so the text says, for they have not rejected thee, but they have rejected me, that I should not reign over them. So notice God looked behind, and why is it that they want a king? Well, they had unjust rulers. They wanted to be like others. But God dug deeper. And God says, I can see behind that make us a king petition, and I can see that they're saying or else. And the reason they're saying or else is that they have set aside divine leadership. So in the following context, they are to go back. And verse 8 reads, it says, according to all the works that they have done since the day since I brought them out of Egypt, even to this day, wherewith they have forsaken me, served other gods, and so they do also now. Now therefore, listen to their voice, howbeit, protest solemnly unto them, and show them the manner of the king that will reign over them. In other words, God is coming across with a grace approach. He's going to say, now they're making a foolish petition. Go back and tell them how foolish it is. And verse 10 begins by saying, Samuel told all the words of the Lord to the people who asked of him a king. Quote, this shall be the kind of king that will reign over you. He will take your sons, appoint them for himself, for his chariots, for his horsemen, some shall run before his chariots. He will appoint for hundreds, captains over thousands, captains over fifties, will set them up to plow his ground, to reap his harvest, to make his instruments of war and his instruments of chariots. He will make your daughters to be perfumers, to be cooks, to be bakers. He will take your fields, your vineyards, your olive yards, the best of them, and give them to his servants. He will take a tenth of your seed, of your vineyards, give it to your officers, to his servants. He will take your men servants, maid servants, your choicest young men, and your asses, and will put them to his work. He will take a tenth of your sheep, and you shall be his servants, and you shall cry out in that day because of the king whom you have chosen, and the Lord will not hear you in that day. In other words, he warns them, if you get your petition, here's what you're going to get. But notice the insistence, verse 19. Israel said, we want a king or else. And so verse 19 reads, nevertheless, the people refused to obey the voice of Samuel, and they said, no, we will have a king over us, that we may be like the other nation, and that our king may judge us, go out before us, and fight our battles. And Samuel heard all the words of the people, reported in the ears of the Lord. The Lord said to Samuel, listen to their voice, make them a king. Now, was it directly God's will that they have a king? No, he said it wasn't. But they insisted. Did he give them what he asked for? Yes. So the answer was, yes, to your petition, you may have your king. And we don't have to spend a lot of time to go through, even in summary form, the period of the kings of Israel. Because as you recall, Israel got her kings and went all the way down the road to declension till God wiped out Israel by their going captive in 722 to Assyria. The same thing happened down in Judah. She had her line of about 19 kings, and they went all the way down till in 606 they began to deport them off to Babylon, and by 586 the city was in shambles, and all of the people were deported out of their land. Of the kings of Israel, there were 20, and you can make this general statement. Every last one of them, without any exception, was bad. Of the kings of Judah, there were about 19 or 20, and of those kings, every last one of them was bad, with a few exceptions. You would get a king in there once in a while, like Hezekiah, under whom you'd have a revival, but it was very short-lived. Under the kings, you had Israel slipping into Baal worship. You had them slipping into the times when it was civil war, it was murder on murder. And down toward the last, you'd have one king on the throne for 6 months, and a guy would get jealous, and he would slip a knife under his fifth rib, and then you would have a new king, and he would last for 3 months until his assistant got jealous, and he would kill him, and you had a horrible declension. You had child sacrifice. You had mistreatment of Israel. You had all kinds of difficulties under the kings. So what happened? They had a motivation, and they made a petition by insisting that they had their answer to prayer. They got it. And as a result, the prayer became discipline. The importance of the attachment of, if it be your will, to any petition made. Another example found in Numbers 11. Numbers 11. Numbers, verse, chapter 11, verses 4 through 6. Verse 4 says, "The mixed multitude that was among them fell to lusting," or desiring. "And the children of Israel also wept again and said, Who shall give us flesh to eat, or meat to eat? We remember the fish which we did eat in Egypt freely, cucumbers, melons, leeks, onions, and garlic. But now our soul is dried away, and there's nothing at all besides this manna before our eyes." Now, I don't know how well we can identify with the why, the what, and the how on this. But the why to their petition was very, very simple. It's how, not well. It really is a wow when we come to it. The why was basically described in fifth verse. They liked the Egyptian diet. And they said, we are motivated by fish, melons, cucumbers, leeks, onions, and garlic. Those last three are interesting, aren't they? Leeks, onions, and garlic. They go from the least strong to the strongest. Leeks, onions, and garlic. I don't know whether there's anything intentional there in terms of their breath, but the leeks would be the mildest, the onions next mildest, and the garlic, of course, would come on like horseradish. At any rate, the basic motivation is, for whatever reason it may have been, they liked Egyptian diet. What were they getting? They were getting this white manna-like stuff, and they didn't like it. And consequently, you have a description of verse 7. It says, the manna was as coriander seed, and the color thereof, the color of delium. And the people went about, gathered it, ground it in mills, beat it in mortar, baked it in pans, made cakes of it, and the taste of it was the taste of fresh oil. And when the dew fell upon the camp at night, the manna fell upon it. You can just imagine. Let's suppose that you've got a diet of grits. You know what grits are, do you not? Enough people in the South know grits, what grits are. Grits are really good, but if you can imagine being on a diet of that, basically grits have almost no taste. That's one of the virtues of grits. Grits taste like whatever you put on them. You put them on your plate, and if you mix butter, you've got butter. If you put honey in it, you've got honey. And the grits just kind of holds together whatever you happen to put in with it. And that, for a diet, that sounds how they make them into spoon bread, bake it and puff it up. If you go in a restaurant, you say, please leave the grits off. You still get grits. There's no way around grits. Grits are there. And even if you request that they be removed, the only thing you can do to get them removed is just take your plate, scoop them off on the floor in the restaurant, and go ahead and eat the rest of your breakfast. But you can imagine having to eat the same thing all the time. I've been trying to lose weight. And as a result, every day, same thing at noon, a salad. And that was fun for a couple of days. But I tell you, I think it's coming. If I see another piece of lettuce, you even get to the sequence of 2 hours afterwards, you begin to taste what lunch tasted like. And it continues through the afternoon because you are getting so sick of the same food that you just can't handle it anymore. All right, this is basically what they were doing, a very practical thing. They were getting tired of manna and manna and manna and manna, and they cooked it, they baked it, they boiled it, they did whatever you could do with manna. They got sick of it and tired of it, and they said, we remember the Egyptian diet, and they began to reflect on it. And they said, we want meat. We're tired of the manna stuff. We want meat. Notice down, for example, in the verse 13, Moses says, from where should I have flesh to feed all this people or to give all this people? For they weep unto me, saying, give us flesh that we may eat. In other words, this was a general rebellion in Israel asking for meat. Now, the thing to keep in mind, this was not merely a petition, Lord, If it's your will, would you give us a break in diet? We appreciate the manna, but would like a little break. That wasn't the attitude or at all. It was give us meat or else. We insist. We've got to have it. Okay, turn over to Psalm 106, where God gives a commentary on this little event. They got their meat, all right. A delicious meat, really. Quail. Psalm 106, verses 14 and 15. Now, we did not, and perhaps we should have gone through Numbers to note that God did finally come through and give them quail. Gave them quail till the quail came out their ears. He answered their petition. But you do have a comment on it in verse 14 of Psalm 106. It says, they lusted, desired exceedingly. And that again was the passage we read in Numbers. Their desire, particularly for food and other things also, became excessive in the wilderness. And they tested God in the wilderness. They just wanted and wanted and wanted and wanted. And, notice the remark, He gave them what they asked for. And notice it flowed from lust, flowed from what they should not desire, what they desired illegitimately. And He gave them their request. In other words, He gave them just what they asked for. They got quail back in the context of the Old Testament, but sent leanness to their soul. In other words, the answer was to what they asked for, yes. Did it satisfy the ultimate desire for the diet that they wanted? No, it didn't. It sent leanness to their soul. So notice you have an idea whereby God said, all right, you have lusted and desired and insisted and twisted my arm enough. Take it. You can have it. But it always came with consequences. So let's put down here a principle, and the principle is this. Prayer without submission to God's will. Prayer without submissions to God's will may be answered. As a disciplinary measure. Resulting in misery. Prayer without submission to God's will may be answered. Now, we should underscore the may, because there's no guarantee in any of these passages that if you keep on asking and keep on asking and keep on insisting, that your prayer will be answered. It may be. But if it's done, it may be answered as a disciplinary measure on God's part, which will ultimately result in misery, as in the two cases that we looked at were in front of us. Now let's go over to James chapter 5 and notice the warning concerning this. James 5. Pardon me, verse 4, chapter 4, verse 13. 13 through 17. 4, 13 through 17. This is the little section that deals with not so much prayer, but the whole attitude of planning that is not submitted to God's will. Verse 13 says, come now, you that say, today or tomorrow we will go into such a city, continue there a year, buy and sell, and get gain. Now notice several things about that verse. Notice basically all that verse is doing is spelling out an agenda. Nothing more than that. And notice in the agenda that the man has, it is come now, today or tomorrow. And notice the elements, and we've been over this previously in James. Today or tomorrow. Notice there is a definite plan for his time. Today or tomorrow, we will go into such a city, or thus city. Plan for time, he planned for his place. We've picked out the city, we've picked out the when. And we will continue there a year. He planned his stay. And fourth, we are going to buy and sell. He definite planned his profit. And buy and sell and get gain. So notice everything you have in verse 13 is reasonable, it's logical, it's correct, it makes sense, it's the way we ought to do it. He knew what he was going to do with his time. He knew where he was going. He knew how long he was going to be there. And he knew that he was going to buy and sell, engage in commerce, and he was going to make a profit. So here it is. We've got the calendar. We've spotted the city. We've made the study ahead of time. We know that our product is marketable in this particular city. And we know that we're going to go into that city. We're going to stay there and work this place for a year. And our business is going to be buying and selling in this particular city for a particular year. And when we come out, we're going to come out with profit made. Now, what's wrong with that? In itself, there is nothing wrong with that, except it is possible that the man could have the attitude that this is going to occur, God's will or not. And notice, he begins in verse 14. First of all, to begin to kind of scare them into this thing. You've got plans for the week. Verse 14 should always be with us. Whereas, you don't know what shall be on tomorrow. Now, I know what you've got in the book, what you've got written down, but what's going to happen tomorrow? You say, well, at 8 o'clock, I'm going to be here. At 10 o'clock, I'm going to be here. I've got this approach laid out for this person, which is going to sell the insurance policy and make me money. I know it is. I've got that confidence. And we have company coming over for dinner at 5 o'clock in the evening. That's what's going to happen tomorrow. Is it? Is it? How many people will have plans like that laid out tomorrow that won't make it? Dozens. Dozens, hundreds, thousands. They'll never make it. The car accident tonight will prevent it. Something will happen tomorrow. And this is exactly what he's driving at. He's saying, look, I'm not saying that planning is wrong. I'm saying this, better hang loose. You better not hang everything on your plan, because there may not be a plan tomorrow for the plan. And he continues, what is your life, the whole thing of it? It is even a vapor that appears for a time and vanishes away. So he says, when you make plans, get perspective. When you make plans, you're thinking about tomorrow. Back off a little bit and look at the total course of your life against time. And what is it? Just a puff of smoke. That's life. Now, verse 15. What was wrong with this agenda? Well, nothing is wrong with the agenda, but here's what you omitted. For you ought to say, if the Lord wills, we shall live and do this or that. So, notice, here is the omission. The omission was submission to God's will. And again, may we repeat that James is not teaching that this man had to say in verse 13, come now, today and tomorrow, the Lord willing. We will go into such a city, the Lord willing. Continue there a year, the Lord willing. Buy and sell, the Lord willing. And get gain, the Lord willing. You hear that many times in speech, and sometimes it kind of, maybe doesn't you, but Sometimes I get tired of someone saying every time they complete a sentence, they have to finish it with, if the Lord willing, as though if they didn't say that, they would be struck by lightning. That's not the idea. You don't have to have the words. You do have to have the attitude. And he says, there's what's wrong with this. You had a plan without submission. And further, verse 16 says, now you rejoice in your boastings. And I would take the boastings to go right back to verse 13. What have they boasted about? We're going to go into such a city, we're going to buy, we're going to sell, we're going to get gain. Now, such boasting is evil. What is evil about it? Plans, no matter how legitimate, are evil when not made in submission to God's will. And what that would mean, also in a practical sense, was this. If those plans are made saying that they must be fulfilled and they don't get fulfilled, what have you got? Personally, you've got frustration. And you may have, ultimately, an ulcer. If, however, the plan is made and you execute it as best you know how, and it doesn't work out, but the mental attitude was submission to God's will, how are you going to handle the messed up agenda? You're going to handle it cool. You're going to handle it relaxed. So, it didn't work. Okay, I was in submission to God's will, but it might not work out in the first place. So what is there to get up tense and tight about? And that is extremely important, looking at it only from the standpoint of what a ruined agenda can do to you. And I'm sure there are people sitting here this morning that is you. When your plan is messed up for the day, what happens to you? Just literally grind on the inside, right down here, doesn't it? Just grind on the inside. You're mad at the person that messed up the plans. You're peeved because why did the kid have to fall down the steps and break his arm when I had a very important business appointment? I end up some dinky hospital waiting for him to set a bone, and it just blew everything, and you're tight, and you're in knots, and its plan didn't work out. You know, isn't that too bad? And God is so grieved, He's so bothered, He's so concerned that your plan didn't work. Of course not. The only person that gets killed on this is you. So notice, in terms of planning, it is a matter of submission to God's will. So if it goes this way, fine. I planned. If it goes this way, fine. I planned. My plan didn't work. So what? This is simply submission in terms of God's will. Okay, let's look at a third possibility in terms of prayer. And it's the only one that we've got left. And that's to take the why, the what, and the how. And ask, is it possible to have a why and get a yes? And to have a what and get a yes? To both of them. We look at both of the other options. Now let's look at the other two. John 11. John 11. Down at verse 41. The setting, of course, is Lazarus has died. He is in the tomb. It says, then they took away the place where the dead was laid, and Jesus lifted up his eyes and said, Father, I thank thee that thou hast heard me. Notice he began with the confidence that the prayer would be heard. Whatever the answer is, we can have the same confidence. God always grants access to His children. Verse 42, "And I knew that thou hearest me always, but because of the people who stand by, I said it." Now notice the motivation. "That they may believe that thou hast sent me." Now what He's going to do in just a moment is He is going to call Lazarus forth from the grave. And the reason for that is so people may believe. He looks at the masses of people, and He desires that they come to faith as to who He is. That's what He wants. That's the whole motivation, is to increase faith. And, verse 43, "When He had thus spoken, He cried with a loud voice," and here is the petition, "Lazarus, come forth." So there is your petition. Lazarus, come forth. That's the thing that was asked for. Why did He ask for it? So that people might believe. How did God respond? Well, God responded to the petition by yes. Verse 44, "He that was dead came forth, bound hand and foot with grave clothes." So verse 44, answer to the petition is yes. Verse 45, "Then many of the Jews who came to Mary and who had seen the things which Jesus did, believed on Him." So what kind of answer did He get? Lazarus come forth? Affirmative. He got what He asked for. Why did He ask for that? So people would believe. He also got not only what He asked for, but He got the desire behind it, or the why also was answered affirmatively. Look at John 17. Now turn to John 17, verse 1, because it gives us a key back to the motivation aspect in terms of prayer. And as long as we can see and claim the identical motivation in terms of prayer, in other words, if we can match the why of verse 17, then prayers usually are guaranteed. Verse 1. "These words spoke Jesus and lifted up His eyes to heaven and said, Father, the hour is come. Petition. Glorify Thy Son." Why? "In order that Thy Son may glorify Thee." So notice the petition was, or the motivation was, "I want to glorify You." The petition was, "You glorify Me." And within context, the idea of glorifying Him, and we'll get into John 17 next Sunday, the idea behind it was, He is going to the cross, death, burial, resurrection, and He's looking forward and saying, in the context, "Father, take Me through the death, through the resurrection, and please give Me My seat back at your right hand." For example, look down at verse 5. "And now, O Father, glorify Me," and this is an expansion of the petition, "with Thine own self, with the glory which I had beside," para is the preposition, "beside You, before the world was." So here He stands, pretending that this side of the platform is looking at the cross, and its suffering, at His death, at His burial, at His resurrection, at His ascension, and He's looking right over here to the Father's right hand from which He had come. And He says, "Father, I want to pass through all of this, and I want that place back. I ask You to take me back to Your right hand once again." That's the petition. Now, why do I want that? Because that will glorify You. So, in order to glorify You, answer my petition. And, of course, you know what the following sequence was. As far as taking His seat at His Father's right hand, He got it. And as far as glorifying God the Father, that is what He is there to do, and that is what He's been doing since. That glorified God the Father. So that, I guess we should put down for the last time our why, our what, and our how. And recall then as follows. Sometimes, as we studied beginning this morning, how can God answer? He can answer by saying, I'll give you what you want as discipline, but I'll make you miserable. So this is giving a yes to the what for discipline. The reason, of course, for that type of answer is our lack of mental submission. So there's one pattern that can occur. So that if you are just absolutely desperate, you cannot live, you cannot subsist unless you have that girl for your wife. All right to ask for it. Ask God to give you that particular girl. But remember, if there is lack of submission, He might give her to you. And years may pass. And you will be trying to find every way in the world as to how you can shed her. And this can do with many, 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 many other things. God simply places something in the believer's hand, and He places it in His hand. You see, that probably gives why, and I often wondered, why did Paul only ask for the removal of the thorn three times? You know, I've heard all kinds of cornball interpretations, like he asked each person of the Trinity, couldn't get it from the Father, couldn't get it from the Son, couldn't get it from the Holy Spirit, so he gave up. I doubt that that's what the passage has in mind at all. To me, the number three is purely arbitrary, simply to teach one thing, that to repeat a petition is not wrong, but the three times indicated an attitude. Paul just wasn't going to drive it to the wall, that's all. And he figured that when I've asked four times and I've gotten a negative all three times, I'm not going to ask number four. Probably assuming that had he done so, there would have been a lack of submission, and therefore he didn't do it, and he took the grace, and he was happy in his mental attitude with it. So this is one, again, to exercise extreme caution. And I cannot say, there's no way scripturally to say, if I would ask for a thing 20 times, might God give it to me? Or do I have to be tense over saying God had marked on His calendar, if this believer asks seven times, I'm going to give it to him and it's going to hurt. Don't worry that point. The whole point is mental attitude, submission. Every time you ask, stop and say this. Will I be perfectly happy, satisfied, or will I be mad at God if I don't get the request? And this requires some very hard honesty, because we're never supposed to say if we don't get something, we'll be mad at God. But though we're in church and everybody looks pious this morning, don't tell me that everybody here hasn't gotten peeved at the Almighty. Everyone here has, because there are times that He just doesn't do things right. I mean, by human viewpoint, I don't mean that literally. There are times He just doesn't do, He doesn't work in people's lives like He ought to. You teach the Word, and it doesn't take effect when someone out there needs it. The Holy Spirit is loafing. He doesn't do His job. Things don't come through on time. We ask for things, and He holds out on us. And it just a little bit down on the inside, though don't ever say it outside now. If you say it out loud, you'll be struck dead. Keep it inside where God won't know it. And you're just peeved a little bit at God. And I know that's true, whether you want to admit it or not, but remember, it's always there. And whenever we make a petition, always stop and ask. Now, if I don't get it, am I going to be mad? And if you are, you might as well go ahead and say, Lord, I've got an attitude problem, because I want this thing awfully bad, and I know that I think I'm going to be mad at you if I don't get it. You won't get struck dead. God never strikes anyone dead for being honest. So just admit that you're going to be a little bit peeved, and it'll relieve the load, and it probably reveal a mental attitude that you at least recognize the attitude is not correct. Then the other possibility is the And we'll put a star above it, simply because it's the most commonly recognized pattern in answers to prayer, and that is when we make a petition to God, and God gives us a negative on the petition, but answers the prayer, what we really desired behind it, in a way much better than we expected. That would be a good place to attach the verse, and someone can give it to me because I cannot recall where it occurs, where Paul makes the remark, he is able to do exceedingly above all that we ask or think. Isn't that Roman? It sounds Romans-y. Can someone give it to me? I cannot recall the reference. What is it? Ephesians 3:20? Okay. Let's put Ephesians 3:20. Let's verify that just to be sure. Right, 3:20. I didn't recognize that because they had moved it from Romans since the last time we taught through. Verse 20, now to him who is able to do exceedingly abundantly above all that we ask or think, according to the power that works in us. And notice the concept of asking in there simply means that we can't even conceive sometimes of how much we ought to ask for. And God is going to exceed this. So that we can always count on, if we get a negative on the petition, always count on something better coming along. On the principle of Ephesians 3:20. And then, of course, your last column is when both the desire or the thing or the why and the what is answered. And that is at those times when one motive was right. And the petition was right. I'll underscore motive because it's more important for motive to be right than it is for petition to be right. Petition can be handled if it's wrong. Motive, again, is a different situation. All right, that takes us then down through to the end of the answer area to prayer. And we have just enough time because the bell is going to ring in just a minute. And that will be our next area of study, which will be prayer in Christ's life, beginning next Sunday morning in the book of Luke. Father, we're thankful for your word today that's living and powerful, and we're thankful for the privilege of prayer in Christ's name. Amen.